Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is J. Miles Dale, a veteran Toronto producer whose credits include Bruce McDonald's Pontypool, Edgar Wright's Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and most recently Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, which, and I still can't believe I'm about to say this, just won the Oscar for Best Picture on Sunday night, along with Best Director, Best Original Score, and Best Production Design. Obviously, I grabbed him before he left for L.A. Miles picked The Big Lebowski, Joel and Ethan Coen's delirious 1998 reinterpretation of film noir, with Jeff Bridges as perhaps the least qualified detective in the history of cinema, a man named Jeffrey Lebowski, a.k.a. The Dude, who stumbles through a complex web of corruption and treachery in the name of replacing his rug. And of course, he's just one of the magnificent eccentrics with whom the Coens have populated the film. The glorious cast includes Julianne Moore, John Goodman, Steve Buscemi, John Turturro, Peter Stormare, Sam Elliott, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and many, many more, all bouncing off each other like bowling pins scattered by, like, a really big ball. You know what I mean, man. This is someone else's movie.
I love the Coen brothers, so it could have been really any of their movies. It could have been any one of a number of movies. But I find that this is the one that sort of tickles me the most. This is the one I can watch again and again and again. This is the one I like to show people. I like to watch with other people.
Yeah.
Which invariably I find it funnier than they do the first time. And then they'll call me back the next year and say, hey, I watched that movie again and it's really good. I find with the Coens, they have the rare ability to mix comedy and extreme pathos, and it is, I think, the hardest thing to do. So I'm always in awe of that. This movie is kind of their screwball, you know, comedy, where it's a little looser than all of that. So it certainly doesn't have that kind of dramatic tension of even you know Fargo and Burn After Reading are, you know, two great examples where, you know, the comedy sadness line is just a very thin line.
Right.
And this, I feel it's looser. It's a lot more slapstick, if you will. But, you know, the Raymond Chandler of it all is all very interesting. You know, where it's a little less plot and a little more fun and going off the beaten track to things that, you know, you aren't expecting, and you're saying, where's this going? And maybe it doesn't even go anywhere, but it was a fun time, you know? So I just, it's the one that I keep going back to. And, you know, I'm not in any of those fan clubs or anything,
right,
but I sort of understand them.
Yeah, I have to admit, for me, I was one of the guys that just didn't think it was all that great. My relationship with the Coens through the 90s was really up and down. I loved the first three films, really didn't like Barton Fink. I get it. I just don't enjoy it. Then they made the Hugsucker Proxy, which made me violently angry.
Right.
Then Fargo, and it's like, oh, no, this is what they do.
Right.
And then they went right back to sort of arch non-realism or whatever the Big Lebowski is, which
right.
is their version of the Altman version of The Long Goodbye, right?
And
they even quote the opening sequences
right.
the same way. And I just found it really frustrating. And I also had the misfortune of seeing it at a packed screening where nobody got it.
Right.
So it just played to silence.
Right. That's interesting.
Because it was early. It was a preview. Nobody knew how to process it. It was,
right.
you know, the new film for
right.
the people.
It's like the first guys that saw the Rocky Horror Show.
I assume, like, yeah, yeah.
Where am I right
what
now?
What right? do I do with this?
And I did not smoke enough weed
yeah.
to be able to enjoy this movie the way I should.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. none of their work, like, they just, stoner culture was not something they'd ever really connected to before
right.
or even tried to interpret.
Right, plus, dazed and confused.
Yeah,
and,
there was a wave of it, but they were outside.
Right.
Because they were, I think, you know, Fargo is the closest thing they've done to a contemporary story at that point.
Right.
Raising Arizona doesn't really count. It's not.
Well, again, Raising Arizona was kind of a broad comedy
to me.
So,
it's a cartoon.
When you go from Blood Simple to Raising Arizona, I mean, that's a big move.
Yeah.
And then you go back to
like the stateliness of Miller's Crossing.
Yeah, exactly. So, Look, I think they show, you know, as we were talking about Soderbergh, they show incredible range, but their temperament and certainly their sense of humor and their erudition and intelligence is all right there. So even, you know, with this, you know, I mean, the John Goodman character, obviously based on John Milius, the writer, the crazy gun-toting guy. Right. I forget exactly what the line is, but something like, you know, you could say what you want about National Socialism, dude, but at least it's an ethos.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's hilarious and it's kind of, you know, funny and true. So it's just like some of the lines. And then, you know, once you've watched it a few times, you really kind of fall in love with the dude. You know, I mean, he's got not much going on, but, yeah. You know, you're really kind of, you know, sympathizing with him like a puppy dog. Like, guy just came in and peed on his rug. Like, it just happened to him, you know?
That was the thing that, in the end, ultimately, that was the thing that got me to watch it again when the DVD came out. I had to cover it. I was reviewing it, and I did take another look at it, and it was, oh, okay, I remember it playing more flat. I don't remember these moments. I was really surprised at how much stuff was still there waiting to be connected to, I guess. But that's it. So it's become this weird, like a train set. Every couple of years, it'll come back around again.
Right, and you see something new.
And yeah, and I'm here. I just feel like I'm on the tracks as it's coming towards me. It's washing over. And right. Like, that's the whole thing, right? You just have to let it flow over you. But I'm not a flower. I'm a much more aggressive engager. And I think that's it. I just had to turn my experience of it off and let it experience me.
Right, right.
Which is a weird way. So I see what you mean when you say you want to watch people watch it.
Yeah, and legitimately, like, I remember showing it to my brother and his wife for the first time, and it was crickets, and, you know, my kids, and, but, you know, I know other people who are like, let's watch it, you know, let's get together and watch it, so, you know, you're just howling, and, you know, it's like, have you got any leads, and, you know, the when you watch the TV thing, and Walter's smashing the Corvette, and, you know, he says, you know, what's the TV line is, a stranger in the Alps, so...
Which has become a meme independent of the film.
Right, which is crazy niching. Yeah. You know, I mean, so it's there must be something to it. And then I worked with Julianne Moore on Carrie. Oh, and she had a great entrance on that movie where she comes into the school to get Carrie. And I said to her, Julianne, I will say that's a great entrance, but certainly not number one. If Maude, you know, rolling in on the wires. So we had a good laugh about that. But yeah, look, it's always... And in fact, I mean, I found her character is obviously a little bit broad, but still sort of interesting, you know? So it's like in the context of the whole thing. I mean, it's like the Sam Elliott character, which is the best, but he said to, he was doing the movie and he said to the guys, what exactly am I doing in this movie? And they go, we're not really sure ourselves, but it's like fun. So, and I remember reading the script after I'd seen the movie. I got a copy of the script and I read the script. And it's like, if you were legitimately reading that script, you'd be thinking, what's going on here? Yeah. But then, you know, they pull it all together. So, you know, the I have a strange sense of humor. Like, I'll just say that. Look, you've got the Mel Brooks thing there. Sure. It's like, I've seen all that stuff. I saw Blazing Saddles 25 times when I was 15. Like, I would go and I'd see the noon, the three, the five, the seven. I would just sit in the theater. I could do the whole movie. So, you know, all that stuff. And and the movie I was telling you about, which you must see.
Yes.
Enter Laughing, which you must see.
Right. This is
for the listeners. One movie you haven't seen.
Well, for listeners, this is a film we could not include because it's not available anywhere.
Right. It was Carl Reiner's directorial debut in 1966. Quincy Jones did the music. It was semi-autobiographical. You know, Shelley Winters, Don Rickles, Renee Santoni, Michael J. Pollard. It was a crazy, crazy cast, and very, very funny. Jack Gilford. And again, that was a movie that my parents, my brother and I, we would watch that on TV, and they would watch us watch it because we were so funny. So that's a little echo of that other thing, but. And that movie, I found it on VHS and I had the guys at Deluxe transfer it to a DVD for me just so I could, you know, give it to my parents so they could see it and not have to wait for it to come around on TV. In any event, you know, it tickles my funny bone in, you know, all the right ways, even when it goes completely off-piece, because I think there's something sort of lovable about almost all of those characters. I mean, you know, Goodman's character, the dude, certainly. I mean, that the Philip Seymour Hoffman character, you know, who's the first lady of the nation. You know, it's like maybe not funny to anywhere. I'll just crack up laughing when I hear him say that. You know, dude, we're concerned. You know,
it's a pinball machine, right? Like, it's a magnificent demonstration of the fallacy of the immovable object and the unstoppable force and all that, because for all the things that the dude accomplishes, all he really does is interact. I don't think he moves the plot.
Right.
He just happens to trigger action in other people. And what happens to Donnie? What happens to Walter? All of these things are other people imposing themselves on him.
Right.
And yeah, he would, you're right.
And Maude, you know. Maude,
well, literally everyone, right? Yeah. Like, he would be perfectly happy to stay in his apartment and not think, or in his house, and not think about this stuff, but someone came in and pissed on his rug.
Right.
And it just sets him in motion to interact with everybody else and annoy them into action.
Right.
It is, that it's the joke about the big sleep, right? Like,
right.
When they asked Chandler who killed the chauffeur, he said he couldn't figure it out himself. Like, and it didn't really matter. The guy just gets killed.
Right. Doesn't matter.
It doesn't the death is what impacts the story, not the chauffeur. And here, I don't even know if you could trace it back that way, but I don't think there is a linear story. It's just not happening to the characters we're following.
But it's the same thing. It's like, it's all fake. You know, the kidnapping's fake. The first money's fake. The second money's fake. Like, it's all, like, really, like, in an existential view, like, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Really.
We know someone loses a toe.
Right.
But that's it. But it's not even the person we think it is.
Right. Exactly. So it's all, I mean, to me, it's really kind of, in a way, it's just scenes. Like, it's just sketches of crazy people doing crazy things.
Mm.
I mostly appreciate it because I think it's original. I just think it's like, it stands on its own as something that there's really nothing quite like it. And I think also with the Coens, you know, as with, you know, Guillermo and some of the other great filmmakers, there's all kinds of, you know, existential stuff underneath everything that maybe only they know about.
Right.
You know, like, people can grab onto it, but they're doing a lot of it just to satisfy their own sense of humor, right? Mm. To amuse themselves. They don't really care if anybody else gets it.
Yeah.
And
I think what they think is funny is actually the key to understanding their cinema, but I don't know that they're intending us to interpret anything beyond the "they thought that was funny" point. But they're, yeah, if you look over the decades, like, the rhythm of their jokes becomes really clear, and the stuff about hats and bad luck and wigs and everything in Miller's Crossing, I feel like there's a connection here with all the weird compulsive stuff that Walter does. And again, they probably just find that stuff amusing.
Right.
But it also becomes a continuum, right? Like, just because they're going back to these things, and the weird repetitions of Santana Abraxas in A Serious Man, which I think is my favorite of theirs.
Yeah, working with Michael Stuhlbarg, I was like, Michael, dude, Serious Man, really? Yeah, I mean, that was obviously a very personal film for them. Not, you know, again, if you're not a Coen Brothers fan, like, that just came and went to
closest
you.
They've ever come to their own lives, their own childhood. Yeah,
right, all of that. So again, I feel like a lot of this is probably just catharsis for them for whatever, however they're feeling at the time, you know.
Yeah,
and I think that was a part of it. I think that they just thought, okay, this is all going to be amusing. I mean, there's so many inside jokes in the movie with the, you know, the John Polito driving the Volkswagen Bug that's from Blood Simple. And I mean, there's lines that are pulled from their other movies, all kinds of stuff that I think a lot of the time they were really just trying to amuse themselves. And again, they're good at that. Like, you know, in Burn After Reading, like, that whole crazy Brad Pitt character, like, who could get away with that? Like, like, that doesn't play anywhere at any time for anybody ever. And it totally worked in the context of a guy who just needed, like, you know, what between him and Jenkins and Francis McDormand, that movie, like, what they were doing. And it made no sense at all. But so to me, that's like getting, like, brave. Like, you're out there on the wire without a safety net with that kind of stuff. And there was, you know, a lot of that in this movie, too. Certainly, I mean, I think this is John Goodman's, and he's been great in all kinds of Coen Brothers movies. I think it's absolutely his best performance, because I think it's a brave performance, you know.
Yeah.
They come in on the guy with the iron lung, you know. We're big fans, sir, especially the early episodes.
It's It's such a specific thing to say.
Right, like exactly.
They know Walter Sobchak better than, well, better than they know him, better than
yeah, himself, or just but. that kind of a character who would say that kind of a thing, you know? It's just those kinds of things where it's just, I don't know, it just tickles me all the way through. And you know, the thing with Bunny, that's kind of the parallel, you know, from to have and have not, you know, you do know how to whistle, don't you? You know, I mean, so there's all that kind of fun inside stuff, but really for me, I just laugh. You know, the cop comes up to the car, you know, the guy shits in the back seat. He's like, you know, dude asks him if he's got any leads. You know, leads, yeah. Got a team of detectives working on. So it's just, I just feel like it's one of those things. Anything you can watch over and over again, like for me, and there are, you know, many movies that are, you know, it's like when you, I'm sure somebody's done The Shawshank Redemption on this show.
No, not yet.
Yeah,
weirdly enough, I keep waiting for it to come up.
That would have been on the podium for me for sure. But, you know, or, I mean, you know, The Godfather, you know, every time you're changing channels, and there are the movies that you stop at always. And those are a couple of them. This is certainly one. So anything you can just watch over and over endlessly again, there's some reason for it. And this is certainly like that, or anything Mel Brooks has done, but certainly the sweet spot of Mel Brooks, the sweet spot of Barry Levinson, you know, that 5-year period, you know, where he was, you know, on fire. So,
so the character stuff that draws you in, is it the sort of the offset genre thing?
I'm always
fascinated by what.
Well, I do like black comedy because I think it's rare to be able to pull it off. You know, I feel like, you know, dark comedy, it really requires a very specific point of view from the filmmaker, and I feel it's almost, you know, the most telling reflection of the filmmaker and you know what their kind of psyche is, and that's why I think the Coens like appeal to me. I just feel that they've got that thing where they can do it all. It can be very high drama, you know, high stakes tension, and you know, side splitting comedy at the same time, which is virtually impossible. I mean, I can't think of too many other guys who really can do it that way. So for me, like that's part of it with them. But I also find, even in the performances, I watch the performances and I see little subtleties every time, you know, I mean, and just, you know, scene stealers like Totoro and, you know, some of those little things where I feel like those, are inspired, you know, and that can't be on the page, you know, and so again, and with Trusted, you know, Totoro, how many movies had he had already done? Four movies, he was like in the rep company practically.
Sure, yeah.
So you look at something like that, and then the other thing we have talked about is the dream sequences.
Yeah,
which, you know, in this whole crazy stoner world, you know, flying around on the carpet, the dude's just having a great time, and then all the musical stuff and the bowling and I mean that cinematography. You know, I know how hard it is to make a movie. Okay.
Yeah.
And those things that they were doing, you know, that was pretty decent green screen integration for a low budget movie for its time, for guys who had never done any vis effects. Mm-hmm. That Busby Berkeley stuff that they had going was crazy.
Well, yeah, I was going to say I tried to explain it to somebody once, not too long ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Somebody was talking about the frog sequence in Magnolia and how that's essentially a music video.
Right.
And I said, yes, of course, but, you know, like the year before, there's a gargantuan 35mm music video for a 30-year-old Kenny Rogers song that no one remembers, and it stars, you know, everybody.
Right.
And it has bowling in it, and they're just right. Like, I don't think he had connected the two at all, but I don't know that you get Magnolia without the Big Lebowski. It's such a weird continuum.
Right.
Same continuum.
Yeah, I'd never thought of that, but it's very true.
But I can totally see Paul Thomas Anderson, because Boogie
Getting
Nights
inspired
is,
by it.
Yeah, Boogie Nights and the Big Lebowski have so much in common.
Yes.
I can just see it cross-contaminating somehow.
Yeah. So I just remember seeing that for the first time, and it just also blew my mind, because it's like, okay, just, you know, where this movie had gone into some odd places, now it's going, okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now I'm off-piste entirely. So that was very impressive to me.
Well, there was nothing in their filmography that suggested that this is where they would end up.
Right.
Not just the music sequence, but the entire movie. It's so completely unlike them.
Yeah.
But then no two films of theirs were alike to that point.
No, that's true. And even then, I mean, they come next with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which interestingly, I thought had some elements, you know, of that. Like, it felt a little bit like the son of everything they had done before, you know. And I think Big Lebowski was their first movie with T-Bone, I think.
I think you're right. There wouldn't have been need for it.
Because it was all, like, score before that, and there were a lot of songs. So I think it was the first, and then obviously Oh Brother, and then a few others. But so I just remember also thinking, you know, that fantasy with all the bowling and thinking about how they shot that. And the first time you're not really, but, you know, as a producer and a director, you know, you watch those things and you're thinking, oh my God, like this was not a big budget movie, but this stuff is time consuming and very specific,
yeah,
you know, and it's not like just two guys sitting in a room or, you know, the dude and the stranger at the bar where you just pull back into the two shot and they talk and then it's over. Right? They never left that two shot.
Yeah. Well, so much of film noir is just conversation.
Right.
So I just think it's wonderful that their way of exploding it is to just not adhere to those restrictions in any way at all.
Right.
Just, you know what? We're going to ride around in the car for a while.
Yeah.
They do that. That's fine. But we're also going to have a massive musical number.
Right. And I'm sure, and I should actually talk because now I've met Joel a couple times with Francis this year. Ask him if they spent a disproportionate amount of time and resources on those things, because I think there's just no way to do those, you know, fast mm-hmm. and half-ass. And that was Deacon's, I think that was the third one that Deacon's had done with them. And yeah, he was obviously jazzed by that. So yeah, that was also kind of a thing of media where, you know, just when you think, oh, this is fun and this and that, it goes off into that world. You know, and the whole thing with the Jackie Treehorn and the bouncing trampoline with the naked girls in yeah. slow motion. Like, again, it's just like I appreciate the visuals and they don't, you know, again, there's nothing really arbitrary about any of their coverage even, you know, in terms of camera movement and this and that. And
not so very...
it was it's a treat again just because it's so just when you think you know where it's going or what might be happening, it just takes you somewhere else. And yeah. that's the thing. You know, you love the surprise. And like, in some movies, that can be, by the way, it takes you to a place I don't care and you've lost my interest, you know, which has happened a few times this year, even with some of the more notable films, in my opinion. But that was not one of those. I just thought it has a real kind of like a fun life force to it that you know, just makes me smile.
Yeah. So we haven't even really discussed Jeff Bridges at all, but I don't want us to slide past the fact that that performance is so incredibly not Jeff Bridges. I mean, I've met him. That is him.
Right.
He is the dude. It's kind of incredible. But he is also known for such incredible focus as an actor, and for this, he makes it look easy, but you can always see what's going on. He's an incredibly demonstrative performer, and to dull himself down and just to sort of kind of take the smart out of him. Weirdly enough, Sam Rockwell does something similar in Three Billboards this year.
Right.
I was thinking about that, and they're completely unrelated,
mm-hmm.
but they both have this instinctive understanding that the only way to sell this character is to hide how smart the actor is.
Right.
And Bridges just being befuddled, it turns out, is this amazing comic engine.
Yeah.
And people are trying to explain things to him and he's not letting it penetrate. I was stunned when I realized that was going on.
Well, it's hard to play a stoned guy, you know, and it's hard to play drunk. It's hard to play stoned. But I think the secret there was the timing and some of the lines. I'm not exactly sure if there was, I looked at the script and it appeared to me that there was not a lot of improvisation.
Mm.
And those guys are, you know, famously not
good
improvisers. Like, what's on the page is what's on the page. And they write it so specifically. So I just thought, yeah, he showed just incredible comic timing. It's funny, I think of the Sam Rockwell character as being not that smart. I don't feel like the dude is dumb. I just feel like he's out of it a lot.
He's just,
you know, like he's got a, He's kind of dumb. he's kind of dumb. But really, it was the thing. It was him and Goodman working together, too, that is the fun, because those guys, you know, their rhythm together was incredible to me, because it's so easy for it to just go, you know, over the top, and it didn't. Even when it did, it didn't, you know. And I think Jeff Bridges, I mean, he's a remarkable actor, incredibly versatile, but yeah, obviously very funny, you know. Yeah. So it's nice when guys show you a new color, and I mean, he definitely did. I'm sure he was the only one in their mind that was going to be able to play that. You know, it's a they're very specific about their casting that way. And he hadn't been in anything for them prior to that, right?
No, it was his first one. They don't collaborate often. There was that, and there was True Grit, and unless I'm missing a really obvious one,
True Grit. Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, I think that's it. So yeah, I feel like, you know, they're so specific in their casting. You know, the only thing, the Steve Buscemi character was a little bit of a, he felt like a bit of an add-on. Like, that was the only thing I was, like, I was wondering, was that what they were sort of going for? Was he, you know, not really even there in a way? Like, the dude never really talks to Steve Buscemi, and Walter really only tells him to shut the fuck up, Donnie.
Right.
So it's yeah. That's a little bit of an odd character that I sort of wondered about. Like, what was the payoff with Donnie ever?
Yeah.
And even like when he dies, like, you don't really feel that much because you don't really know him.
Yeah. I think that was, I think like my first time through, I really didn't care about the funeral, like,
right,
at the end when they dispose of his ashes. It's, well, kind of a quick joke.
Great scene, by the way, and I've done that. You know, I've used that line. It is our most modest receptacle.
Right.
I will go out of my way to... And by the way, sometimes in questionable situations when people have died, you know, where
it's a
funeral, you know...
Everybody needs a release.
It is our most modest receptacle. Mm. And the blowing in the wind of the thing. I mean, yeah, you know, I've worked all of that in my life various times.
But I've come back to it and thought that maybe... I mean, he's sort of the only character who isn't, he never gets angry, he never gets hostile, he's really sweet, and
right,
he just wants to help. And so if you want to argue that the whole film noir thing is about people chasing the thing that they don't understand and ultimately finding themselves, then all they're doing in this is ignoring him and then realizing what they've lost at the end, because they've only been pursuing stupid, selfish, petty things, and Donnie, he's just not into that. But Donnie, yeah, he's pretty dumb.
Right,
he's,
yeah.
I think he's dumber than the dude, because
right,
he's completely,
right,
as far as I can tell, he's more or less straight and sober, but he doesn't understand anything.
Right. I am the walrus.
Yeah.
Like, what?
But he's just quietly yeah, trying to help.
Yeah, I sort of think the thing at the end is also their own mortality, right? Like, I mean, their own mortality is literally being blown in their face.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of cool and funny at the same time. Again, it's like, that's real life coming at you. But, yeah, I think, you know, I mean, all the performances are really pretty phenomenal. The whole thing with, I mean, Julie and David Thewlis. I mean, again, that's...
I still can't believe he's in that movie. It's such a...
Yeah, no, it's
just a weird place to find him.
Yeah, strange piece of casting. Great in Fargo this year. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, I know he's in it, but...
Mind-blowing.
Him and Spielberg. So far behind.
So, yeah, and the rest of them, you know, and the Nihilists...
Yes.
And David Huddleston, who just died again, like a strange piece of casting. Like, you wouldn't have seen that coming.
Mm-hmm. But he is, like, Huddleston's sort of that Charles Durning quality that they love so much, that
yeah,
the Coens always return to. These portly, Michael Lerner's another one.
Right, yes.
Portly,
he showed an interest.
Actors. Yeah. They're just, they love that guy. That character who
yeah,
always shows up.
Or Polito, even.
He's like a comic trope, but also a dramatic trope. Whoever is playing him in this given movie, it's always sort of the same character.
Yeah.
And then the only... I was trying to figure out if there is one in like, Llewyn Davis, for example. It's F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah.
Who is gaunt and almost, like, judging, like, God in the end.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, Llewyn Davis, actually, I feel like they really, like... eased up on the humor entirely, right? Like,
oh, it's so sad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, beautiful.
Deadpan, but
yeah,
sad.
But really, you know, just kind of a chronicle more than anything, that movie, right? It's
yeah,
like, just, okay, put a follow, you know, my shoe came off in the snow. I'm just going to follow you around, man. But even like Huddleston, like some of those lines, like, you know, I will not abide another toe, and right. the stuff in the back of the car, and the stuff in the, you know, are you employed, Mr. or, you know, what are your name? So, I mean, delivered with a straight face, it's like, it's just so impressive to me that guys can pull that stuff off.
Yeah.
And Phil Hoffman, like I said, that whole thing. And that's pretty early for him, right?
Yes. Yeah. He was just coming up, really. I mean, there was Boogie Nights the year before, and
right.
people were starting to know who he was.
Yeah. Again, I just think, like, tonally, like, all those performances ride a line. And they are all very brave, because it's just, you're one step away from taking people out of the movie with every one of those performances.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with the exception of, I would go with Hudsucker, where Jennifer Jason Leigh is clearly doing the thing they've asked her to do. And it just makes you wonder why no one else is. It's so specific and tonally wrong.
Right.
They are really good at that. They're great at establishing mood. They're great at, like, they'll do the thing that Soderbergh does and weaponize room tone. They just make you understand the environment you're in.
Yeah.
And somehow they get all the actors to line up. I always come back to this. It was an Edgar Wright quote, actually. He was talking about Scott Pilgrim. He said that the trick to making it, and I'm sure you heard this from him a number of times, the trick to getting that movie made is that everybody's pulling on the same rope with the same tension, and you have to convince them what the tension is.
Right. Yeah. And we did talk about that.
Yeah.
And yeah, because tonally, if something's off piece, well, again, the best example, I mean, Brad Pitt in Burn After Reading, there's no version of that in any movie. Like, somehow he pulls that off, and you believe it. He's hysterical. Like, could you imagine going in to an audition for that part and reading it like that? And you would say, thank you very much, validate your parking, and you're gone, you know?
Yeah. It's Benicio del Toro and the Usual Suspects, right? There's no one else who would think of that.
Right.
But so they did, because they wrote it for him.
Like, so, you can feel their confidence. So I feel like those things. So, again, you know, very enjoyable to watch. And, you know, in a way, the other thing is, like, because you don't know where it's going, it's like, okay, this is happening, it's fun, but you come back to the plot, you know? So it's like, okay, I'm off on this thing, but then I come back, and it's like, okay, the money.
Yeah.
Okay, what the money? Oh, the toe. Oh, the girl. Oh, that money's not fake, you know? And so, really, just, you know, checking in with the plot every now and then.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's like, know? The film sobers up and remembers.
Yeah.
But instead of becoming, because
that's where it is noir, because noir, as someone said, you know, wants to be, it's more about the scenes than the plot.
Right.
And the great scenes will, you know, make the plot okay, but make it great, you know, make the scenes memorable, make the characters memorable. And that's kind of what it is, even though, again, it's a pretty broad, you know, landscape of characters. I mean, you could definitely say some are superfluous, for sure, but it almost doesn't matter, because it's like, I mean, it might as well be a sketch comedy, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, okay, I'm over here with this guy, you know, I'm hanging with the Jesus, and, you know, I'm walking door to door with the Jesus. Well, I don't really care about the Jesus so much, except he really entertained me in the thing with the polishing the ball. You know, and I had a laugh, and I don't know Smokey, but I know he stepped over the line, you know, and like, so I don't know, it's just those characters just amuse the shit out of me.
Yeah. A lot of it does feel like an extended game of yes and in the screenplay stage, where it's like, well, okay, but then this has to happen.
Right.
All right, let's do that.
Right. And I'll see your insanity.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, and then again, like I said, you can look at it from a guy who, you know, the world is just coming down on him. And I think that everyone can relate to that. So, you know, you put yourself in your own life, and it's like, the dude, it's like, I was just hanging out and this thing happened to me.
Yeah.
And whatever that thing is to you, you know, there's some parallel, you know, I've got a goofy friend like Walter, who doesn't have some friend, not as crazy as that, right. But you know, we've all got that friend,
yeah.
You know? So I feel like, you know, there's also relatable. Oh, you know, dude meets Maude. It's a girl. You know, it's out of his league. Oh, I'm gonna get laid. It's like, oh, that didn't work out so well.
Yes, no, exactly.
So I feel like those little touchstones too are kind of relatable for anybody, you know, just in life too. So there's that.
It's always struck me as an anti-stoner film in a weird way, because so many movies that involve like drug culture, drug humor, they just remind me that it is a lot less entertaining to listen to people talk about the stuff they did when they were high.
Right.
Than it is to be high yourself. Like, right. Whatever is going on is always more interesting to the people experiencing it at the moment. And then later, you babble about it, which is kind of the thing that Lebowski avoids because of the film noir device.
Right.
Because we're invested in the mystery if we're not invested in them.
Right.
And so the second time through, you can start to understand. I warmed to the characters maybe three times in.
Right.
The first time I was trying to understand what was happening. The second time, I was appreciating the structure. It's like, oh, this is doing this intentionally, and this next thing, you know, a movie is always a better experience the second time through because some part of your brain knows what's coming.
Right.
Even if you don't like it, a movie seems less bad.
Yeah. Unless it's the Crying Game.
Well, yeah. But then you get to experience the first 40 minutes and go, oh, I see all of this stuff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Not necessarily better, but certainly different, and you can appreciate it. And look, many movies are better the second time. Some are better the fourth and fifth, just because you get nuance that,
I
could watch The Shape of Water. I've seen it 20 times, and I see some new nuance every time I see it, you know? So, and I feel that way about this movie, is that I'll pick something up, some obscure reference. Also, now that I've read about the movie a little bit and, you know, you get some context on it, and
sure, yeah.
I've resisted asking Ethan and Joel any about, you know, I've met them a couple times now, and I don't want to geek out on them. I geeked out on Julianne a little bit.
I've interviewed them a couple of times. They will not tell you anything they don't want to tell you.
Right.
Feel free.
Yeah.
I did actually, the first time I met them was on the Serious Man Roundtables at TIFF, and somebody tried to start with a Lebowski reference, and Ethan just shut him down, and it was magnificent.
Right.
Just somebody trying, like a younger journalist trying to be like, it was like his first thing, and was something about, he tried to work in Dude and Ball, talking about a serious man, and Ethan just looked at him with cold eyes and said, that's funny. And they just left it hanging, and I thought, I want to applaud. These guys have been dealing with this for 10 years now.
Of course. Enough already.
Yeah, and they don't, like they'll dig as far as they want to, but they really won't go into detail of something. Like the most intricate conversation I've ever had with them was talking about how they did the process backgrounds for the subway scenes in Llewyn Davis.
Right.
Because that was a challenge they were really excited about.
Right.
But they won't talk about the Dylan stuff. I mean, they'll talk about Dave Van Ronk, and they'll talk about things that are peripherally interesting.
Right.
And in A Serious Man, they talked about their childhood, but they kept saying, but this isn't really about us. This is about a fantastical situation.
Right.
They're just like, I love their impenetrability.
Right. Yeah. They'll just give you what they want to give. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're smarter than everybody, so you're not going to outsmart them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and especially on that movie, which I think they probably, had, a very personal film. They were going to want to talk about the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But with Lebowski, they'll just say, we were being silly, or, this was really interesting and we didn't know we'd get the rights to the song. But the Gulf War thing never comes up.
Right.
Or if it comes up, they just deflect it by saying they think the period of time is interesting.
Right.
But obviously it's there, so Dude will do the This Will Not Stand.
Yeah, it's all about being able to say this unchecked aggression will not stand.
And it's hysterical.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's stealing a line. Well, the irony of the guy who's one of the Seattle Seven stealing a line from George W. Bush, right?
Well, George Bush Sr.
Or Sr., rather.
It's 91. But then to get to that point, right, that's where the yes ending comes in, because now they've ended up making a period film.
Right.
About only 6 years ago, but it's like the kind of challenge you set for yourself. Incidentally, I just find that fascinating. There's really no other reason the film needs to be set then.
In 1991.
It's just funny for that one moment.
Well, you got the Saddam bowling shoe guy.
Oh, that's true.
Fun too. But that probably came after that,
Yeah.
Look, I'm sure they heard George Bush say this unchecked aggression will not stand. And we're like, how can we work it in? And that was the thin edge of the wedge, right?
Yeah. And here we are.
That was great in Ralph's, the 69-cent check. Written on September 11th, 1991, not to mention.
That's a weird-ass movie.
That is a weird-ass coincidence.
Yeah.
But, it's funny with the period movies. I remember talking to Bob Graff, who produces their movies now, about No Country for Old Men, which was set in...
It's like 82 or something?
Yeah, like the mid-80s, and they went and shot in West Texas. I said, it must have been tough with the cars, and he goes... No, in West Texas, all the cars are from the mid-80s. We just used people's cars. It wasn't hard at all.
Jeez.
I think they just probably don't care to talk about old stuff at all anyway. They're really interested in the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, as I am with them. I mean, it just seems to get better and better. I mean, I think Hail Caesar is a major work of art. I really think it's a brilliant movie in so many ways.
Yeah. So, I love the conceptual challenge of doing production numbers for movies that don't exist, but not just one. Like, just doing series of different styles of different
tones. Yeah, I mean, and casting Channing, because you know he can do that. Like, he's not only got the acting thing, but, I mean, that Anchors Away number was wow, you know? So I feel like, and as Guillermo said to me on this movie, like, what am I going to do that I haven't done? You know, because why would I do something I have done? You look at that and you say, they say to themselves, okay, let's go and really challenge ourselves to do something that we haven't done. And they seem to do some version of that every time out. Like, it doesn't feel like they're really trotting old ground. And that's where I put the greats, you know, with Guillermo and Edgar and Soderbergh, we've talked about in these guys, is that they're just constantly evolving as artists, where you know it's them without any credits.
Yeah.
But it's somehow different, better, more evolved. Like, you know, you're watching the growth of a major artist. And that's the interesting thing to me about all those guys. And certainly with them. I mean, it just seems to get better and better. I mean, look, there's obviously, you know, bumps in the road. It was interesting to me watching Intolerable Cruelty, which they had originally written for someone else to direct. Yeah. And then they ended up directing it. But it didn't feel as much of an auteur film to me as their normal thing. So the fact that, you know, that distinction would exist even was odd to me. You know,
have you seen Gambit? The one they wrote but didn't direct? It's a rewrite of a 60s comedy. It's a heist picture with Colin Firth. It
must be terrible.
I assume so. I still haven't watched it.
Isn't that something?
But it's one of those things where you find out about it and it's like, wait, there's a lost Coen Brothers movie?
Well, again, like, I was so looking forward to Suburbicon. I really was.
Me too.
I mean, you know, I like the material. I love the cast. I think Clooney's a pretty good director.
Yep.
They're obviously good writers, and it's like, what the fuck happened there? So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's all very strange, but I love the development, and you could see it right from the beginning. I mean, you could see it from Blood Simple. They grabbed you, and you know, there's the odd, you know, chance that they've taken along the way that maybe didn't land, you know, quite the same with, you know, any of us based on personal taste.
Sure.
But the body of work is just, you know, it's staggering. It's exceptional. And by the way, not big budget guys. Like really, you know, very responsible. And again, guys who want to keep control by not spending too much money where they're pulling attention, you know. And I love that, you know. Because basically, I think with them, it's like, look, just give us the money and don't talk to us, and we'll give you the movie. Like, good. And we're not interested in notes. You know, we can. We're casting magnets.
Like, yeah, we'll
can
get stars.
We'll get anybody because they know everyone wants to work with them, or whether they know it or not, the actors do. And you know, consistently, you know, they've got the, you know, the biggest actors. So I admire that part of it, that they want to keep it small and they're not, you know, prone to excess that way, which is, you know, easy to do. It's easy to go in that direction. And by the way, the fact that I heard that Hail Caesar was like $23 million or something like that, or under 25, mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, I thought it was closer to 40, 50.
It looks like.
It's expensive.
You know, it's like we're getting that a lot with our movie right now. But, you know, I just couldn't be more impressed. Now, you know, I mean, that Big Lebowski, a different story a long time ago, but I think it was not an expensive movie.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't have been. And was it still Gramercy at the time, or was it one of the early Focus ones? They would have banked on it.
It was Gramercy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They put out some really interesting stuff.
Yeah, 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 very interesting. Yeah, and they've worked around the edges that way, too. I mean, they do a lot of their movies with working title, so whether it's in the Universal deal, or they've been all over. And I think anyone's happy to release any of their movies, because I think most of their movies are probably going to do pretty well at the end of the day. They've got a pretty loyal following, so.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
I've never been to one of those shows, the Big Lebowski...
the live shows?
The gatherings.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it would be...
I think it feels
a little inside.
Yeah, I don't think I would want to go there.
Yeah.
It's like, it's becoming a cult, or it is a cult now at this point.
Right.
And It's not something I want to be part of, really.
Yeah.
I'm much happier, as you can tell, appreciating films in the sanctity of my own little box.
Yes, I can see that.
And it's better.
With your wood stove fired up?
It's better for everyone. It's gas. It's fake.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. I think I've got that same remote.
Yeah, everything's fake. But before the construction overwhelms us completely, I can ask the closing question on the podcast, which is, you know, is there anything of the Big Lebowski that you have stolen or borrowed or incorporated into your own creative DNA? I mean, does it influence you in any way?
No, I think it's just, it so tracks with my sense of humor,
right,
that I quote lines all over the place in various contexts, some of which people get. Many times it's only to amuse myself, such as, again, you know, with when someone dies and I ask them about the urn for the that their father's going to be put in. So I'm really skirting trouble with a lot of that stuff. But no, I wouldn't say I've you know, stolen anything. But I more than anything, it just it continues to make me laugh, and it continues to inspire me to try and do that kind of a movie. I actually would, you know, I've directed a lot of TV and one film, and people ask me what kind of film I want to do, and I said I'm actually looking to do a black comedy. So, you know, that's the script I'm looking for and thinking about, because I feel like that is my wheelhouse. I mean, certainly I'm not going to be able to get to that level, but it's the kind of thing that, you know, inspires me to try and do something like that. You know, that's because I just feel like tonally it's in its own world, and it's an underserved kind of niche, the good, dark, you know, and black comedies.
Yeah, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, is there anything you could describe? Like, I don't think you could point to another movie and say, oh, it's like The Big Lebowski. I get what you mean. It's a vibe more than anything. But I think if someone tries to come out and replicate this, it'll be a disaster. It'll be...
Can't do it.
Yeah, it's like a brick wall. You can't break through it and copy pieces of it. But the idea of it, the influence of it, like to be as weird or as funny, as freewheeling, there's all kinds of stuff you can glom onto. You just could never make another one.
Right. Well, you know, screwball comedies. Like, for example, another movie that I would have been happy to come here and talk about is It's a Mad, Mad World.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So again, you take that thing where, okay, there's a plot, sure, but now, you know, I'm off in a garage with Jonathan Winters being tied up, and, you know, just all these wacky situations, yeah, that are kind of funny and with characters. So again, it's a different movie, but it's kind of the same thing where, you know, it's a sprawling kind of screwball comedy that is its own thing. And I think actually would be a worthy movie to examine based on, you know, what Kramer had done previously.
Oh, yeah.
And what he did after. It's such a standalone for him.
And I'm trying to think of a key moment, and it's just chaos in my head. It's just people running around screaming and yelling and driving cars.
The driving and the flying planes,
yeah,
and everything.
And it keeps adding instead of subtracting. Like it's a snowball, right? It starts small and then becomes an avalanche. But no, Kramer was such a kind of a quietly self-important filmmaker who dealt with real issues and social justice and morality plays. And then just in the middle of it all, you know, this.
Right. What, you don't think I can make a comedy?
Yeah.
That was the one I like. You know, someone's like, no, Stanley, you don't want to do that. You don't do that. It's like, yeah, okay, give me a minute. And then, you know, back to whatever his last few
Judgment
were.
Judgment at Nuremberg.
Judgment at Nuremberg, Inherit the Wind, this. Mad, Mad World. You know, that was another movie that really inspired me. You know, I mean, that was an epic movie. And actually, speaking of laser discs, I've got that laser disc with the full...
The Cinerama cut?
The Cinerama cut with the 4-minute overture at the beginning, which is incredible.
I think I might have that too.
So, do you?
I may be in there. I can't see.
It's like 4 discs or something.
I remember
it was a
huge box set from MGM.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, really good. So actually, those are the kinds of things that I actually pull the laser to sell. But, you know, so those kinds of things, you know, are... And in fact, you know what? I'm going to get you a copy of Enter Laughing. I will send it to you. I'll find my DVD and I'll make a copy, because you will die. I mean, seriously. I mean, it's Reiner... just post Dick Van Dyke Show. Yeah. So he's done Sid Caesar. He's done 2000, all the Mel Brooks stuff.
Right.
He's done Dick Van Dyke, and now this is his first movie. And then it was a while till the next one, till I think the Steve Martin movie.
Yeah, he didn't direct.
The Jerk might have been the next one. Yeah. But anyway, you will like it. I mean, I think you'll like it. Particularly not your sense of humor, but I think you will like it. Jose Ferrer, Elaine May. Yeah, it's really good. Really good cast.
Yeah, when you were telling me about it, it's like everyone is in this. It would be a time capsule of that other wave of comedy that just didn't quite kick over into film, right? From the early age of television.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And Reiner. Do you see the Comedians in Cars with Coffee with him and Mel Brooks?
You know what? I don't know that I have now.
It's the best one. Okay. It's basically Seinfeld picks Carl Reiner up. They go to Nate and Al's deli in L.A. and pick up some food. And then they go to Mel's house and sit in front of TV tray tables where, because both the wives are dead, you know, he goes there every night.
Yeah, and they just sit and eat dinner. I definitely have not seen
and watch. It's so cute, those guys.
Ugh.
Who are going to be gone soon. I'm sure they're both
never.
In their 90s now.
Never.
They're close.
Now I'm depressed.
Why?
Well, because I can't imagine a world without Carl Reiner.
I know. Well, it won't be because you'll always have 2001-year-old man to listen to, 2000-year-old man.
Yeah. And we'll always have the Big Lebowski by the same token to just be impenetrable and fascinating and weird.
Yeah.
Someday that'll be old.
Inexplicable.
That's weird too.
Yeah, old. Exactly. So, yeah. Let it live on. The dude abides.
He kind of has to.
The dude abides.
My thanks to J. Miles Dale, who's probably back in Toronto already working on his next thing. If you haven't caught up to The Shape of Water yet, please try to see it in the theater. But if it's not possible, it is available on iTunes and Google Play right now. And 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment releases it on 4K, Blu-ray, and DVD next Tuesday, March 13th. It won Best Picture. It won Best Picture. What a world. You can find Miles on Twitter at MiloFX1. MiloFX number 1. And you can find The Big Lebowski on Blu-ray and DVD from Universal Studios Home Entertainment in an appropriately eccentric special edition. It is also available on iTunes and Google Play. Oh, and it turns out that Gambit, written by the Coens, directed by Michael Hoffman, and starring Colin Firth and Cameron Diaz in roles originally played by Michael Caine and Shirley MacLaine, is on iTunes as well, if you're feeling adventurous. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. The dude abides. The fishman says hi.